This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Irene Friedman, and the program is all about animals. Coming up on today's program, from the National Geographic book, 5,000 Awesome Facts About Animals, I will continue the section 35 Loud Facts About Musical Animals. After that, a new chapter in the ongoing book, A Street Cat Named Bob and How He Saved My Life by James Bowen. I'll be reading that. Then I have something from Modern Dog Magazine, and we'll see how far we get. So, starting off with our facts about musical animals. Bees dance and vibrate to communicate the location of flowers to other bees. The reason humpback whales sing is a mystery. Some parrots can dance to a beat. Reef fish sing at dawn and dusk just like birds do. The club-winged manakin bird knocks its special wing feathers together to create a violin-like sound. Grasshoppers sing by rubbing their hind legs against their front wings like a bow playing a violin. When a frog ribbits in a movie, it's almost always a recording of a Pacific tree frog. And one study found that cows make more milk when they listen to slow songs. And those are our facts for today. And now we're going to move on to our street cat named Bob. This is chapter 16, and it is entitled Angel Hearts. The move to Angel had definitely met with Bob's seal of approval. I only had to look at his body language each day as we headed to work. When we got off the bus at Islington Green, he wouldn't ask to climb on my shoulders in the way he tended to do when we had been in central London. Instead, most mornings he would take the lead and march purposefully ahead of me down Camden Passage, pass all the antique stores, cafes, pubs, and restaurants, and along towards the end of Islington High Street and the large paved area around the tube station entrance. Sometimes we'd need to head to the big issue coordinator on the north side of the green, so we'd take a different route. If that was the case, he'd always make a beeline for the enclosed garden area at the heart of the green. I'd wait and watch while he rummaged around in the overgrowth, sniffing for rodents, birds, or any other poor, unsuspecting creature upon which he could test his scavenging skills. So far, he had drawn a blank, but it didn't seem to dampen his enthusiasm for sticking his head into every nook and cranny in the area. When we eventually arrived at his favorite spot, facing the flower stall and the newspaper stand near one of the benches by the entrance to the Angel Tube station, he would stand there and watch me go through the arrival ritual, placing my bag down on the pavement and putting a copy of the big issue in front of it. Once all this was done, he would sit himself down, lick himself clean from the journey, and get ready for the day. I felt the same way about our new stamping ground. After all the trouble I had had at Covent Garden over the years, Islington seemed like another fresh start for us both. I felt like we were starting a new era, and that this time it was going to last. The Angel was different from Covent Garden, and the streets around the West End in lots of subtle ways. In central London, the streets were mostly crammed with tourists, and in the evenings, West End revelers and theatergoers. The Angel wasn't quite as busy, but the tube station still saw a mass of humanity pouring in and out each day. It was a distinctively different type of person, though. There were still a lot of tourists, of course, many of them drawn to the restaurants and arty menus like Sadler's Wells and the Islington Business Design Center. But it was also more professional and, for want of a better word, more upmarket place. Each evening, I'd notice hordes of people in business suits heading in and out of the tube station. The bad news was that most of them barely even registered the fact that there was a ginger cat sitting outside the station. The good news was that a large proportion of those who did slow down and spot him took an instant shine to Bob. They were also really generous. I noticed immediately that the average purchase and tip at Islington was just that little bit bigger than in Covent Garden. The Angel locals were also generous in a different kind of way to those in Covent Garden. Almost as soon as we began selling the big issue there, people began giving Bob bits of food. The first time it happened was on her second or third day. A very smartly dressed lady stopped for a chat. She asked me whether we were going to be there every day from now on, which struck me as a bit suspicious. Was she going to make some sort of complaint? I was completely off the mark, however. The following day, she appeared with a small Sainsbury bag containing some cat milk and a pouch of Sheba. "There you go, Bob," she said happily, placing them on the pavement in front of Bob. "I'll probably have that at home tonight if that's okay," I said, thanking her. "Of course," she said, "as long as he enjoys it, that's the main thing." After that, more and more locals started donating tidbits for him. Our pitch was down the road from a large Sainsbury supermarket. It soon became obvious that people were going in there to do their normal shopping and were picking up a little treat for Bob on their way round. They would then drop their presents off on their way back home. One day, just a few weeks after we began at Angel, about half a dozen different people did this. By the end of the day, I couldn't fit all the tins of cat milk, pouches of food, and tins of tuna and other fish that had been piling up all day into my rucksack. I had to keep it all in a large Sainsbury bag. When I got back to the flat, it filled up an entire shelf in one of the kitchen cupboards that kept us going for almost a week. The other thing that was a world apart from Covent Garden was the attitude of the staff at the tube station. At Covent Garden, I was the antichrist, a hate figure almost. I could count the number of people with whom I had forged a good friendship in the years I had been busking or selling the big issue there on the fingers of one hand. In fact, I didn't even need that. I could think of two at most. By contrast, the staff at Angel were really warm and generous towards Bob from the very beginning. One day, for instance, the sun had been blazingly hot. The mercury must have been up in the 90s at one point. Everyone was walking around in shirt sleeves, even though technically it was autumn. I was sweating like crazy in my black jeans and black t-shirt. I deliberately placed Bob in the shade of the building behind us so that he didn't get too hot. I knew that heat was bad for cats. An hour or so after we had set up our pitch, it became clear to me that I'd soon need to get some water for Bob. But before I was able to do something, a figure appeared from inside the tube station with a nice clean steel bowl brimming with clear water. I recognized the lady immediately. Her name was Davika, one of the ticket attendants. She had stopped to talk to Bob on numerous occasions already. "Here you go, Bob," she said, stroking him on the back of the neck as she placed the bowl in front of him. "Don't want you getting dehydrated now, do we?" she said. He wasted no time in diving in and lapped it up in no time whatsoever. Bob had always had this ability to endear himself to people, but it never ceased to amaze me just how many seemed to become devoted to him. He had won the Islington crowd over in a matter of weeks. It was amazing, really. Of course, it wasn't perfect at the Angel. This was London, after all. It could never have been all sweetness and light. The biggest problem was the concentration of people working the area around the tube station. Unlike Covent Garden, where all the surrounding streets were alive with activity, at the Angel, things tended to be concentrated around the tube. So, as a result, there were a lot of other people operating on the streets, from people dishing out free magazines to charity workers, or chuggers, as they were known. This was one of the biggest changes that I had noticed since I started working on the streets a decade earlier. The streets were very much more competitive than they used to be. The chuggers were mostly hyper-enthusiastic young people working for charities. Their job was to collar well-heeled commuters and tourists and get them to listen to a spiel about their charity. They would then try to persuade them to sign up for direct debits to be taken from their bank accounts. It was like being mugged by a charity, hence their name, chuggers. Some were third-world charities. Others were health-related, to do with cancer or other illnesses like cystic fibrosis and Alzheimer's. I didn't have a problem with them being there, but it was the way they hassled people that annoyed me. I had my own sales spiel for the big issue, of course. But I wasn't as intrusive or as nagging as some of these. They would follow people down the road, engaging them in conversations they didn't want to have. As a result of this, I would see people emerge from the tube station, see a wall of these enthusiastic canvassers, usually in their loud colored t-shirts, and make a run for it. A lot of them were potential big issue buyers, so it was very annoying. If someone was really driving people away, I would have a word. Some of the canvassers were fine about it. They respected me and gave me my space, but others didn't. One day, I got into a heated argument with a young student with a mop of Mark Bolan-like curls. He had been really irritating people by bouncing around and walking alongside them as they tried to get away. I decided to have a word. "Hey, mate, you're making life difficult for the rest of us who are working here," I said, trying to be civil about it. "Can you just move along the road a few yards and give us some space?" He got really antsy about it. "I've got every right to be here," he said. "You can't tell me what to do, and I will do what I want." If you want to get someone's back up, you just need to say something like that. So I put him straight on the fact that while he was trying to make pocket money to fund his gap year, I was trying to make money to pay for my electricity and gas and to keep a roof over my and Bob's head. His face kind of sank when I put it in those terms. The other people who were a real irritant for me were the people who sold the assorted free magazines that were being published now. Some of them, like Style List and Short List, were actually good quality magazines, so they caused me no end of problems, the simplest of which boiled down to a question. Why were people going to pay for my magazine when they could get a free one from these people? So whenever one strayed into my area, I'd try to explain it to them. I'd say to them straight up, "We all need to work, so you need to give me some space to do my job. You need to be at least 20 feet away." It didn't always work, however, often because a lot of the vendors who gave away these magazines didn't speak English. I would try to explain the situation to them, but they didn't understand what I was trying to say. Others simply didn't want to listen to my complaints. By far, the most annoying people to work the streets around me, however, were the bucket rattlers. The charity workers who would turn up with large plastic buckets collecting for the latest cause. Again, I sympathized with a lot of the things for which they were trying to raise money. Africa, environmental issues, animal rights, they were all great, worthwhile charities. But if the stories I had heard about how much of the money disappeared into the pockets of some of these bucket shakers were true, I didn't have much sympathy. A lot of them didn't have licenses or any kind of meaningful accreditation. If you looked at the laminated badges around their necks, they could have been something from a kid's birthday party. They looked amateurish. Yet, despite this, they were allowed inside the tube stations, a place that was an absolute no-go zone for a big-issue seller. It would really narc me when I saw a bucket rattler inside the concourse hassling people. Sometimes they would be standing right up against the turnstiles. By the time they emerged out of the station, the commuters and visitors were usually in no mood to be persuaded to buy the big issue. It was, I suppose, a bit of a reversal of roles. In Covent Garden, I had been the maverick who hadn't stuck to the designated areas and bent the laws a bit. Now, I was on the receiving end of that. I was the only licensed vendor in the area outside the tube station, and I had worked out the areas that I could and couldn't stray into with other main sellers there, the newspaper vendor and the florist in particular. The chuggers, hawkers, and bucket rattlers ran roughshod over these rules. I guess some people would have thought it was ironic, but there were times when I failed to see the funny side of it, I have to admit. And that's the conclusion of chapter 16, and we're just plowing right through A Street Cat Named Bob. Okay, from Modern Dog Magazine, an article, How to Teach Your Dog to Read, and then in parentheses, yes, really. And it has a cute illustration. We see a service dog leading a visually impaired person, and the dog puts on glasses and is reading a sign that says, posted on a telephone pole, "No dogs allowed," and the dog looks distressed. So kind of a cartoonish illustration taking up the left side of this article. But anyway, here's How to Teach Your Dog to Read. Yes, really. A pioneer in the training of service dogs proves that dogs can, in fact, be taught to read. Here's how and why you should teach your dog to read by Stanley Coren. And the illustration I just described is by Michelle Simpson. Imagine a guide dog for the visually impaired who, when his owner says, "Find the exit," immediately moves to the closest door that provides a way out. Imagine that this dog can also find the appropriate men's or women's lavatory when his owner asks him to find the washroom. Even better, imagine that this dog can notice the areas in its environment that are posted danger, keep out, and then guides his charge away from such hazards. Now, exactly which abilities would it take for a dog to be able to do such things? For a human, such tasks are fairly straightforward. A person can simply scan his surrounds and look for the signs which indicate exit, men or women, or danger. To utilize information on those signs, of course, the individual has to know how to read. So now we must ask, can dogs be taught to read? One person who asked this question specifically about whether dogs assisting the visually impaired could be taught to be literate is Dr. Bonnie Bergen. She is a remarkable woman who is credited with inventing the concept of the service dog to assist people with mobility limitations. That was back in 1975. She later went on to found Bergen University of Canine Studies. Its campus is in Pengrove, California, and it is the only university in North America where you can get a Bachelor of Science or a Master's degree in Canine Studies. Dr. Bergen's graduate training was in special education for people, not puppies, and over the years, she was able to show that using the same kind of educational practices that you use for young children works well when you are trying to train dogs to perform fairly complicated activities. But do dogs have an adequate level of intelligence to allow them to learn to read? There has now been a lot of research which has confirmed the fact that the average dog has intelligence, which is equivalent to a human child around 2 to 2.5 years of age, while the super dogs, the breeds in the top 20% of canine intelligence, have mental abilities equivalent to a human child age 2.5 to 3 years. Although having the mental ability of a human toddler is good, it really isn't good enough to allow a dog to learn to read canine classics like Call of the Wild. We don't actually expect toddlers to read continuous text. However, they spontaneously do learn to recognize some signs, some alphabetic letters, perhaps a printed version of their name, as well as various logos that they are exposed to on a regular basis. In other words, they are capable of word and symbol recognition. That should be okay, since after all, a word is nothing more than a visual pattern which happens to have designated significance. Before you start teaching your own dog to read, your pup must know a few commands and reliably respond to them when given a verbal or hand signal. For the average dog, the commands sit, down, stand, turn, come, roll over, touch, and so forth will work fine. Before you start, you will need to make flashcards for the 4 or 5 behaviors your dog knows best. You can make the flashcards by printing the words by hand in large block letters using a felt tip pen. You can also use your computer. Just choose the largest, darkest font and avoid any typeface with squiggles, serifs, or other fancy elaborations. Print one word per page in black ink on plain white sheets of paper printed sideways or landscape orientation. You can laminate the cards or slip them into plastic page protectors to make them more durable, since nose prints and drool marks will be distracting for your novice reader. Begin with a command that your dog knows well. Just not sit, since your dog is probably already sitting because virtually every exercise starts that way. Instead, try down. Show the flashcard, say the command, move the flashcard out of sight, and reward the dog with a desirable treat when he lays down. Keep going like this for a few trials, and then see if the dog responds when you simply hold up the flashcard. Use short sessions and don't overload the dog. Learning the second word will be more difficult, since it is likely that the dog is initially just responding to the appearance of the flashcard and not carefully scrutinizing the word printed on it. So, let's say that the second word is sit. Now, with the dog standing, show the flashcard, say the command, drop the flashcard, and if he responds correctly, reward the dog. He will get confused at first because now he has to carefully inspect what is written on the card, but with patience. He will work it out. The next step is to mix up the two words, sit, down, down, sit, and so forth, making sure that your dog is always starting from a standing position. Once your dog is doing this well, you can add a third word and then slowly proceed from there. And then in parentheses, it has one further instruction. Due to the interest so many people had in teaching dogs to read, Dr. Bergen wrote a book outlining the process step by step. It is titled, Teach Your Dog to Read. I have verified that you can use the same principles to teach your dog to respond to logos or symbols, and this gives you an opportunity to control your dog's behavior even when you're not around. It helps if you have already taught your dog the command, leave it. For my dogs, this command is interpreted as no, or stop that, or stay away. The symbol which I use on the flashcard is the universal sign for something that is banned, namely a circle with a slash through it. Teaching the recognition of this is a little bit harder, but worth the effort. And then again, in parentheses, you'll probably have to keep the dog on leash until he learns, because you may need some extra control here. Basically, you set up a situation and something the dog desires, say some treats. Put a few treats in your hand or on a dish, show it to the dog. When he approaches it, give the verbal, leave it. At the same time, you interpose the flashcard with the symbol with the circle with the slash through it. When the dog stops trying to get to them, he is praised, the flashcard is dropped, and he gets a treat. This takes lots of practice because, like a toddler, the average dog does not have wonderful impulse control, but it is worth the effort. You see, once the dog has learned the leave it symbol, you can designate places where you don't want the dog to go. Prop up a flashcard with the circle slash symbol on the kitchen counter to help deter a dog from surfing the surface for edibles. You can also prop that symbol up on a piece of furniture that you don't wish the dog to go onto, in the same way that you put up a keep off the grass sign to keep people from tromping all over your lawn. And then in parentheses, yes, this actually works if taught properly. Dr. Bergen now routinely has her service dogs learn to read a dozen or so words and symbols. She claims that dogs can learn 20 or more words, but it takes hard work and patience. Her enthusiasm about this process is evident when she says, the possibilities for reading dogs are endless. When you teach a dog to read, you're not just teaching him a cute trick to show your friends. You're developing his mind and helping him become a better problem solver. Now we have a very short sidebar, the top 10. Super dogs in terms of working and obedience intelligence. And I will read them in order. 1. Border Collie. 2. Poodle. 3. German Shepherd. 4. Golden Retriever. 5. Doberman Pinscher. 6. Shetland Sheepdog. 7. Labrador Retriever. 8. Papillon. 9. Rottweiler. And 10. Australian Cattle Dog. And then it looks like there's also a sidebar for a book review, so I'll read it. Angels on a School Bus by Dr. Roberta K. Ray. A true story that will leave paw prints on your heart. And here's their little synopsis here. A large school bus crammed with over 100 German Shepherds and Huskies, half of which are pregnant, is heading for Alaska as winter approaches. When the bus breaks down in Butte, Montana, volunteers undertake one of the most challenging dog rescues ever. Angels on a School Bus is a triumphant rescue story and much more. The author includes many photos and heartwarming stories of how these unusual dogs have blessed those who adopted them. It's available from Amazon and through your local bookstore. And all royalties are donated to dog rescues. And my guess is that was an advertisement, but it does sound like an interesting book. And now here is something from Bad Pets Hall of Shame by Alan Zullo. And this is the Holy Cow Badges for Creating Unnecessary Trouble and Mischief. The Bad Pets Hall of Shame inducts the following. And I'm going to read about Kenita and Lainey, who are llamas. It was a llama drama, a llama palooza, a llama mamma mia. Whatever people on social media, on cable news, and in newspapers called it, Kenita and Lainey. created a brief nationwide sensation when they ran amok in a suburb of Phoenix, Arizona in 2015. TV crews on the ground and in the air broadcast live the two llamas' wild dash for freedom. Like juking and jiving basketball players, the two dodged handlers, cops, passersby, and lasso-flinging pursuers trying to catch them. The dynamic duo stopped traffic on busy streets, startled shoppers and residents on sidewalks, and captured the attention of the internet. It wasn't supposed to happen that way. Bob Bullis and his wife Karen Freund, who owned 9 pet llamas, were bringing 3 of the animals, Kenita, Laney, and Alejandro, to the Carillons, an assisted living facility in the retirement community of Sun City, for residents to see and pet as a form of therapy. The normally mild-mannered animals became spooked when the door to the trailer transporting them unexpectedly opened before it came to a stop in front of the house. The 3 llamas bolted out of the transport, and the chase was on. Alejandro gave up right away while his rebellious comrades performed their own version of the Great Escape. Turned into quite a spectacle, watching live by millions of people streaming the escapade on Twitter, Facebook, and local national news feeds. Pursuers chased them on foot and in golf carts, police cruisers, pickups, and bicycles. Cooks at the facility ran after them while holding heads of lettuce, trying to entice them to stop for a snack. Kenita, a 5-year-old white llama, sprinted ahead of the shorter 1-year-old dark-furred Laney. The pair often sprinted into oncoming traffic as people, Maricopa County Sheriff deputies, approached them with arms outstretched. Weaving here and there, sidestepping this way and that, ducking and darting, the 2 llamas made fools out of everyone who tried to catch them. During the hour-long chase, the animals dodged cars as they crossed Thunderbird Road multiple times, disobeying pedestrian and vehicular laws and forcing those who were following them through neighborhoods to run in circles, the Arizona Republic reported. This being Arizona, several persons with ropes showed up and figured they could snare the runaways with lassos. No problema. Laney was the first to be lassoed by 2 men near 103rd Avenue. Kenita remained on the loose for another 15 minutes, still looking like a live stuffed animal, a Dalai Lama. But she was finally lassoed by a guy riding in the bed of a pickup truck that had been tailing the animal. Kenita bucked and shook in defiance, but they gave up and returned to her owners without any more fuss. Neither animal nor human was hurt in the zany pursuit. Although the chase was over, the fun was only beginning on social media, which generated hundreds of hilarious memes picturing the llamas with such captions as "The Fast and the Furriest," "Thelma and Louise," that's double L, and "Como Se Llama," Spanish for "What is your name?" or "Como Se Llama." A TV station captured the video of the pursuit as a slow speed chase. On Twitter, the hashtag llamas became a trending topic worldwide, spurring hundreds of thousands of tweets, including hashtags llamas on the loose and llama drama. Even the NFL got in the act. The Arizona Cardinals football team tweeted that it agreed to 1-year deals with a llama on the loose. Each llama will earn 2,340 pounds of hay. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were impressed with Kenita's running skills, tweeting, "Gotta love how well she avoids the defense." And with the first pick in the draft, the TB Buccaneers picked the white llama. And with that, I am completely out of time. This has been Irene Treeman reading all about animals. Thank you for listening. Spay and neuter cats and dogs. And everyone out there, you have a great day and a great week. Goodbye, everyone.